Welcome to the Texas Crime Cast by the Dallas Morning News. I'm Jen Emily. Joining me in the studio today are Tasha Taparis and Tristan Hallman. This week is all about anniversaries, but not the good kind. No happy memories here. It's been 20 years since Darlie Routier stabbed her two young sons to death in the Dallas suburb of Rowlett. She still sits on death row. We'll talk about why some question her guilt and why others have no doubt. A year has passed since James Boulware shot up the Dallas Police Headquarters in the middle of the night. Many lives could have been lost, but in the end, only the gunman died. As we reflect on what could have happened but didn't, we take a look inside the minds of those in the line of fire and those who feared the worst as they worked to end Del Boulware's night of terror.
How could anybody kill those babies? I don't understand it.
Devin was laying face up on the carpet with his eyes open, and the last thing that young boy saw in his lifetime was his killer, his mother, coming down at him with a knife.
I did not murder my children. I love them.
So it doesn't bother you that you have no eyewitness, no motive, no sense, and no confession?
She did everything to herself. She's put herself on death row because of what she did to those two children.
That was ABC News' Sylvia Chase interviewing both Darlie Routier on death row and Greg Davis, the lead prosecutor in her case. The interview was not long after she was sentenced to die. Tasha, since this horrific crime happened 20 years ago, catch up those who don't know what happened to her sons.
Well, Darlie Routier is obviously on death row for killing her two sons, Devin, who was six at the time, and Damon, who was five. The story is that they were asleep in the family room downstairs. Her husband, Darren, was asleep upstairs, and her their seven-month-old son, was also asleep. Darlie's story was that an intruder had broken into the home, had cut through a screen over a window in the garage and come in and taken a knife from the house and stabbed the boys and stabbed her, slitting her throat. And then she woke up to this happening and chased him off and he fled. She called 911. Darren was also in the room at the time that they were calling 911. And the officers arrived. She told the story. But as they continued the investigation, they believed that her wounds were self-inflicted and that she was actually the killer.
What is the best evidence against her? What was it that it convinced the jury that not only that she killed her sons, but also that she belonged on death row?
Well, there was a lot of blood evidence, her blood, her son's blood. There didn't really appear to be anything that actually proved that an intruder had broken into the home. The investigators said that the scene appeared to be very staged. The murder weapon was something in the house. It was actually a kitchen knife from their own home. And the kind of argument was that who breaks into a house and then takes a weapon from the house and uses it. She also had blood spatter on the back of her nightshirt that they said was from raising her arm above her head to stab her sons. And then also they pointed to her attitude after the fact, saying that she seemed like she didn't have a lot of sadness or grief about the deaths of her children, and that she seemed mostly concerned with herself. Also in the 911 call, she kind of made an odd statement where she said, I touched the knife. I hope that they can still pull fingerprints of it from whoever that was. And the argument was, okay, why would you say that when you're worrying about your dying son?
And what did she have going for her at trial? What was the defense's case?
Well, there were some kind of odd little bits of evidence. There was an unidentified bloody fingerprint on the coffee table. The defense was saying that because there was no one in the house that the fingerprint appeared to match, that it proved that if there was blood on a fingerprint, that it was someone from outside. Also, there was a sock probably about 75 yards down the alleyway, the back alleyway behind the house, that had blood from both boys on it. And no one could really explain how that sock had gotten there because it appeared that someone who was fleeing the house had it on his person and it fell.
Who would take a bloody sock with them, though?
Yeah, it's an odd odd thing. There are some theories about what the purpose of that sock was, but also the timing of it is kind of the point of where the confusion is, because one of the children, Damon, was still alive when paramedics arrived. The 911 call on which Darlie and Darren were both heard in the background was about 5 minutes and 44 seconds, and the medical examiner testified that Damon could not have lived with those wounds for more than 9 minutes. So it's a pretty short time period in which, if Darlie had done this, she would have had to have slit her own throat, cut the screen, run down the alley, leaving no blood trail, to discard the sock to kind of throw police off. So that was kind of the point of that.
So how did the prosecution actually explain those kinds of the fingerprint and the sock, or did they?
Well, the fingerprint was, they said, was possibly from one of the boys. But there was never any conclusive evidence to match it to the boys. The sock still seemed to not really ever have an explanation.
It was really more about the totality of the evidence. If you put everything together, this crime scene looked like it had been cleaned up. There was a vacuum in the floor, and under it were Darlie's bloody footprints. And it kind of didn't really make sense what was the vacuum cleaner doing out.
And Blood in the sink
and things like that. And Darlie explained the vacuum by saying, oh, I was using it as a cane to get around, but her legs were working fine. So it's a little bit confusing. And the towels that were used to sort of stop the bleeding, they were wet. And so Darlie said, oh, I went to the sink to get, wet the towels to put on. But, why would you put wet towels on a wound?
Yeah.
I mean, why would you take the time? And that's really not, it's the worst way to stop blood to use something that is wet. It's very confusing.
A vacuum also seems like a terrible cane.
It really does.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And Darlie changed her story a lot. She told the nurses when she was treated at the hospital for the what was called at trial a superficial wound to her neck. She told the nurses different things about what happened, and they would bring those nurses to testify and tell all of Darlie's stories. And Darlie took the stand herself, and it was something the prosecutors thought that she would do. So Greg Davis was the lead prosecutor, and Toby Shook was the other prosecutor. And Toby Shook is the one who questioned Darlie, and he kind of took great pains to have her nail down her story, which is that she woke up, saw a man walking away, but she also was certain it wasn't her husband. And it was, there's a lot of questions about, how did a mother sleeping right next to her kids, a foot away from one of them, sleep through something like this? How did she sleep through, being stabbed herself? And then at one point she had said that one of her sons woke her up and that saved her life. And so there's a lot of confusion. And when you tried to put all her stories together, they didn't really make sense. And during the trial, she didn't really have a lot of emotion. She didn't cry when talking about her sons or the funeral or anything like that. The only time she cried was when the prosecution showed her letters that she had written while in jail, talking about how she knew who had done it. And she got very angry about, the fact that they had those letters, and said, oh, it's illegal for you to have these letters. And one of the jurors actually laughed when she said that, apparently. So her story wasn't going over well. She really hurt herself.
What you rarely ever hear of people testifying at these kinds of cases. Why did she take the stand?
She made that decision. I spoke with the investigator for the defense, who still to this day believes that she is innocent. Very strongly believes that. In fact, in his reasoning for some of the confusion around her story was that he believes that she kind of passed out during the attack and came to, wasn't really a slept through, but rather was, had lost consciousness. And so he thinks that that's why she was unclear. Oftentimes defendants have the right to speak in their own defense. But sometimes that's not really helpful because you're going to be cross-examined and your story will be picked apart. But she believed that she could show that she was innocent.
There are a lot of defendants, and I don't know that Darlene Routier is necessarily one of these defendants who believe they can explain.
Right.
And they want to just, if they only had the chance, if they could hear me, I'll just tell them how it happened and they'll believe me.
If I just tell my story and explain, you know, how I did not do this and reiterate what she had told police, that she felt that the jury would believe her.
You know, one of the interesting things that I saw watching, you know, Making a Murderer on Netflix was the jury's reaction to someone not testifying too was, oh, well, if he has nothing to hide, why isn't he taking the stand? And I guess that bias works against you as well.
Right. And juries are told you should not take it into consideration. You cannot take it into consideration. But, you know, come on. I mean,
yeah, we're all human. It is one of those things that logic, you know, we think, well, if I hadn't committed a murder, then I would come out and speak up for myself. So I think in her mind that by telling her story, she thought that they would believe her.
Did they ever establish, the prosecutors ever have a narrative of what the motive was for this? It just seems
sort
so senseless.
Sort of, yes. It does seem very senseless, which is why a lot of those who believe her innocence still to this day say that, you know, there was no reason for her to kill her children. The prosecutor's narrative was that, you know, her husband had been doing very well in business, but had recently started having financial troubles, and that she was used to a certain way of life, and that the boys got in the way of that way of life. And basically she cracked. And I guess there was a little bit of insurance money on them, not a whole lot, not enough to get them out of debt. But it wasn't a strong, this is why she did it. But they did have kind of paint her as materialistic, and that the children, you know, were just in her way.
And I think a lot of people who believe in Darlie's innocence have a hard time believing that a mother would do this to their child. And we've seen time and time again that, you know, a mother can do this. And, or, you know, there are people who do it for a variety of reasons. We've postpartum psychosis, where you hear voices and you believe God or the devil or someone is telling you to do something. And that never came up in Darlie's case. But then, you know, there are people who, like Tasha was saying, who do things for money or for they're having a hard time and they snap, and it, you know, could have been any of those things in Darlie's case or something.
And it's worth noting, too, that this wasn't too terribly long after the Susan Smith case. Susan Smith had killed her children and pretended that someone had taken the car. And the motive there was that she had a new boyfriend and he didn't want to be around the children. So some of that parallel was drawn in the Darlie case as well.
And Tasha, whenever people talk about Darlie Routier, those who remember her case, they always mention Silly String. Why is this such a big part of the case?
It sounds rather silly to talk about Silly String in connection with the very brutal death of two boys. But what happened was shortly after their deaths, Devin was actually supposed to turn 7. And that day, several family members, friends, Darlie herself, at this point she had not been charged in the boys' deaths, had a bit of a prayer and memorial service at the graveyard, at the gravesite. But then they also had a quote-unquote celebration of life for his birthday. And Darlie's sister had brought balloons and silly string and poppers to make it like a birthday party. And I'm told that there were some children in attendance as well. And so they wanted to have it seem a bit more lighthearted memory. And so there is news footage of Darlie laughing, kind of chomping her gum and spraying silly string on her dead children's graves. And that was actually played in court. And it was pointed to as, if this were a grieving mother, would she be literally dancing on her children's graves, spraying silly string? The family says that it was really meant to be a birthday party, and that it was unfair that the news captured that short moment rather than the 2 hour or so prayer service and memorial service beforehand. But it definitely stuck in people's minds, and it still sticks in people's minds. Every person that I talked to, or even Jen talked to about this case, you know, it came up, the silly string. People remember the silly string because in a lot of people's minds, okay, if she were innocent, if she were a victim, how could she do that?
I have a tough time with that being used to sort of convict someone, though, because, I mean, people grieve in different ways.
Yeah.
But the totality of the evidence, as you were mentioning, I mean, it does sound like that. But I don't think you should convict someone based on silly
string. Josh and I had this conversation before her story about the anniversary ran. And, you know, I think you asked me, you know, what if she was innocent? Would we still judge her? And I guess my thought is, if the murderer was still out there, and that was her reaction, I still think it would. I think it would be weird. And obviously, people grieve in different ways. People laugh at inappropriate times out of, you know, nervousness, not because something's funny or because they're so stressed they just, you know, have an odd reaction. And so, yeah, people grieve in different ways. But if, you know, you watch the video and you see her face, you can really, you don't see grieving and you don't see pain. And it's not the just a little burst of laughter. I mean, I just watched it again right before we recorded this, and she looks like she's having a good time, and I think that's probably more than just the silly string. It was how her face looked and her reaction.
Yeah.
But you're right, Tristan. Yeah. I mean, it is hard to, you know, really look at the criminal justice system and say that it can be completely fair when those things are taken into consideration. You know, I actually laughed at my grandmother's funeral for a moment because some of the children there were doing funny things. But this was in between tears, and I might have looked like I was having a lot of fun, but I was also devastated. So it's hard to judge that.
Right. It's sort of like, you know, if that were me, well, it's not you. It's not. You can't say how you'd react. So.
Right.
And Darlie had a third son who was upstairs asleep, apparently with Darlie's husband, Darren.
Yes.
And he was only 7 months old at the time, and now he's 20, and he's visited his mother in prison as long as he can remember. How is he doing today?
Well, he is living in Lubbock with his father. He actually has leukemia. It is apparently a rather curable form, but he has been going through cancer treatment for about 3 years. And his family says that he's nearing the end of that treatment, and they hope that he will make a full recovery and be able to go on to live a long life. But yes, I mean, he has grown up knowing that his mother is on death row, and you know, and the reason for that, and grew up knowing that his brothers had been killed. And, you know, I'm told that the one time he was able to actually speak to his mom on the telephone was when he was calling her in prison to say that he had cancer. So this is one of those moments where you really remember the victims of crime that often were very sad for the ones who have died. But, you know, this young man has had to grow up basically without a mother, without his brothers. And, you know, it just seems just kind of an ill twist of fate that he ended up getting cancer as well at such a young age and has had to battle that.
That was police radio traffic after the attack last year on Dallas Police Headquarters. You can certainly hear the stress and the urgency and the panic, but yet a sense of calm in their voice. Tristan, can you tell us what did happen a year ago?
Well, it all started when a man who is, I guess the best way to describe him is unhinged, pulled up. He bought a zombie van, a zombie apocalypse van, and which had gun ports on the side. He left some explosives in the DPD parking lot, and he decided to he had a high-powered rifle, just unload on headquarters. You know, his parents both claim that that they don't think that he intended to hurt anyone, even though he had said, you know, some things about police, that the world would be better off without these cops in them. He lost a custody fight for his son. So it had nothing to do with Dallas Police Department, but he held it against the police. He was a man from Paris, Texas, and the police ended up, you know, obviously they shot back, and he ended up a couple hours later after a chase getting taken out by a sniper in a Jack in the Box parking lot.
And he pulled up to DPD headquarters.
Right.
And his van is sitting out there. Can you tell us a little bit about, you know, what happened next? The police notice his van.
Right. And so we you know, Naomi Martin and I, who couldn't be here today, interviewed the people that were sitting at that front desk. It was two cops and a maintenance man who liked to, you know, shoot the breeze whenever they were working the late shift together if things were slow. The front one of the officers worked security at the front desk. Obviously, the police department's closed at night. Although they might, you know, let someone in depending on the circumstances. One of the officers actually saw the van pull up, and he thought, well, that's, you know, that's kind of odd. He was parked by a fire hydrant. His gut told him something's not right here. And so he said, I'm gonna go tell that guy to move. And the other officer, one of the other officers said, no, don't worry about it. He's not bothering anyone. It doesn't matter. You know, I guess in this instance, proactive police work actually ended up saving their lives. Because had he gone out there, those bullets were definitely targeted at them. You can see from the curb. You can see with the lights, you know, kind of dimmed. You can see where the officers are. They went right above the bullets. Went right above their heads. They all hit the deck. They're all very lucky to not get hurt or hit at all. And the you know, some of the cops around the corner. There are police officers who work at headquarters at night, and they came over and started shooting back.
And your story with Naomi takes the reader through not only what happened inside the minds of those officers who were right there and, you know, nearly walked outside. One of them nearly walked outside and, you know, could have been hurt if not killed. But
and there was actually one of them who walked right up to the van. And there's some witness video of that, too. He was on the side of the building and he didn't really know what was going on. He heard the first volley of gunshots and he went right up to the van, looked inside and saw James Boulware, the gunman, reloading, just completely focused on his gun, just reloading, and the officer just took off. He realized what he was up against. He didn't realize who the shooter was actually in the van. He thought he'd see someone standing there.
And so your story is really a sort of all inside the heads of these officers and inside the head of Chief Brown, who actually heard the gunshots, who was awakened from his condo two blocks away. And you have the thoughts of a young sheriff's deputy as she helped in the police chase that eventually, you know, brought about the ultimate end of all of this. It was, you know, it was a very scary night. And you were out there.
Yeah, out there is not the same as being involved in the action.
No, but you were.
Yeah, I got a call from our editor. You know, I obviously it was past midnight on a Friday. I wasn't paying attention to all the things going on police-wise. But it said, you know, something's going on. You need to get out there.
You weren't in harm's way, I should clarify. But
no,
you were.
No,
you
more
were,
than any of us are on a daily basis.
you went out there and were, you know, you are watching it all unfold or listening as it all unfolded. And you know, obviously knew that while, you know, there was still an active shooter situation. And
right. And at the time, you know, we thought it was a lot of people thought it was a terrorist attack or that there were multiple gunmen, that this was obviously we had the lone gunman situation at the Austin headquarters. But the assumption always is, and because there was such high power rifle and so many gunshots that and people didn't know where it was coming from, that this was a coordinated attack.
And you talked to Chief Brown for this story. Let's hear a little bit from him now.
And so as I came out my front of my residence, I saw the officers. And I'll never forget the young officer that I saw first. I don't remember their names. The look of fear, just that wide-eyed, head on a swivel, kind of fear with their gun out by their hands. And you know, I'm asking what's going on. We say, got a guy shooting at us, he's pointing. And my instincts are to do what every cop would do, is just get involved. But my responsibility is to manage the situation. And so I actually have to drive the opposite direction of where the activity's going on.
How did you approach the officers to get them to share their stories? I mean, it's sometimes there's a reluctance to, you know, let a reporter or the public, you know, inside their minds, but they really revealed a lot about what they felt and thought that night.
Sure, and it took a little work. Obviously, the police chief got on board with it a couple months afterward, so that helped a lot. Basically, told them it's okay. Some of them still didn't want to talk to us. Obviously, we didn't talk to the sniper. I was told he was boring anyway. But they really started to open up a little bit. They realized sort of the history of it, and they really let us into their thought process while it was all going on. And I think that it just helps that no police officer was actually hurt that night. That it was a close call, that there was a lot going on. Obviously, this is probably the biggest thing that a lot of them will ever face.
And one thing that Chief Brown talked about in that audio clip is that he, you know, wanted to go out there. He was former SWAT. I mean, it was, you know, what he used to do. But he couldn't go there. Where can you talk about what he did that night?
Sure. He hadn't drawn a gun on someone for many years, but that instinct is still within you. I mean, if you go out to lunch with any cop or former cop, they're always going to want to face the door. They always have the instinct in them that if things go wrong, I want to be positioned well.
I always want to face the door too, just for never been a cop.
I do too. Yeah. Well. Yeah.
They've taught us well.
Yes, they have. He went to City Hall. He drove over there where they have an emergency operations center in the basement. I've actually been in there. It's pretty cool setup. They got some screens all over. They're like projection screens. From there, they can also look basically at the floor plans of any building in the city. They can manage the situation from there. It's central command when things like this happen. First Assistant Chief Charlie Cato, who's now in Mesquite as the police chief there, went out to the field and was commanding from there, and there was just constant communication as to what was happening.
After all of this happened, I guess we should say that, you know, Boulware died. He was shot.
Yes.
And how did the night all end? Because it was a while. He was killed, but we didn't all know that this was over for a while after he actually died.
Right. And, you know, it got more and more tense each time. There was a report of, another explosive. Obviously, they found some explosives at DPD headquarters, but maybe another one at Northeast Patrol. I didn't buy much into that. It just didn't seem like it would fit the pattern at the time. And, you know, it was long. It was tense. There were a couple of press conferences. The sniper, when Boulware popped up, fired. And they were actually afraid that such a high caliber sniper rifle, which they used to penetrate the armored van, it was armored, the bullet would keep traveling and hit someone else. So that bullet stayed in the van, luckily. And so they took him out, but it took a while to figure out if he was still alive. They were afraid he was going to play possum, and that the moment they went over there, that he was going to pop out and start shooting again. It was too risky. So they sent a robot over there. He looked pretty dead from the sounds of it, and they determined the best way to go forward was, because they didn't know if he had any explosives in the van, was just blow up the van. You know, the best thing you can do is just get rid of it. Let's not take any chances.
And were there explosives in the van?
I believe it did explode after a little while. There were definitely materials in there.
What were the changes that happened within the police department and to headquarters after the shooting? They obviously repaired the building itself, but more than that happened.
Right. You can still see some of the, you know, effects of it. So the information sign got shot up, so there's still a little bit of stuff missing, or you can see where they kind of paved over, new drywall over some of the bullet holes. They put up, they have new security at the front, which doesn't, I mean, really, it wouldn't have prevented this attack. But it is a it
and
is
by
a
new
measure.
Security. It's really just like metal detector.
It's a metal detector and a city building security officer who asks you, "Where are you going?
Right? Why are you here?
Yeah. What are you doing here?" The glass is not bulletproof. That would have been a big expense. And what they said was that rifle that he was using would have penetrated it anyway. I'm not sure that was. It's obviously a cost effective move. But I'm guessing those guys at the front desk would feel a little safer if it was bulletproof.
Let's hear from Chief Brown one last time about his fears that night and always.
Our department is arguably the best in the country, and we're prepared to deal with it, but it just, is something that is it's hard to deal with, given the nature of my responsibility is that the first thing I want to do is not lose a cop. I don't want to have to bury a police officer, and so that's heavy on my mind all the time. This is a reality of what is happening in the world today.
That's all for us today. Thanks for listening. Mike Hashimoto is chilling on a beach somewhere, so there's no hashing it out today. He returns next week. Read more about the stories we talked about today on DallasNews.com, and remember to like our page on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. We are at Texas Crimecast. You can subscribe to us on iTunes and never miss an episode. Thanks to our sound engineer, Tommy Noel, for Tasha DeParis and Tristan Hallman, I'm Jenna Mully. We hope you stay safe out there.